Iran begins a 10-day celebration period to mark the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Reports emerging of Saudi security forces arresting prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Qadim al-Amri. His fate and whereabouts are unknown. A third day of protests paralyzing traffic in Canada's capital city. Truck drivers blocked the streets near Parliament to protest vaccine mandates. This is World News from Tehran. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The event is marked every year with a 10-day celebration period known as the 10-day dawn. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali was at this year's ceremony and filed us this report.
43 years ago this day, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad Airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A prominent Iranian cleric, Ayatollah Lutfi Safi Golpayegani, has passed away at the age of 103. The Ayatollah died from a cardiac arrest after staying at a hospital in Qom for the past week. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has issued a message of condolence on the cleric's passing. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Ayatollah Sistani, has also expressed his condolences. Ayatollah Golpayegani was a member of Iran's Assembly of Experts, a body tasked with appointing the Islamic Revolution's leader. He was also a member of the Constitutional Council that vets candidates for public office. Over his decades-long career, Ayatollah Golpayegani trained hundreds of researchers and wrote dozens of books. He was a pillar in the field of Islamic jurisprudence, as well as a master in mysticism and practicalness. The reports out of Saudi Arabia suggesting that security forces have arrested a senior Shia cleric. Local sources are reporting that Sheikh Qadim al-Amri has been taken away to an unknown location. The reason for his detention is not known. The Sheikh is the most prominent Shia figure in the city of Medina. He runs a famous mosque in the whole city where local Shia Muslims and foreign pilgrims gather for congressional prayers. He is the son of Sheikh Mohammed, the top Shia authority in the kingdom, who passed away more than a decade ago. Saudi Arabia has ramped up crackdown on dissent. Last week, a court sentenced another Shia cleric, Sheikh Abdul Latif al-Nasser, to 8 years behind bars. Well, earlier we reached out to public analyst Saeed Chahabi for his take on the arrest of the prominent Shia cleric by Saudi forces, and he believes that the West, the U.S. in particular, is paid by the kingdom to put a blind eye to its crimes.
The arrest of Sheikh Kadhim al-Amri from Medina is a serious blow to any saying or to any claim that the Saudis are going to reform themselves. It is unlikely that the Saudis will tolerate them at all, because this is their structure, this is how they are. They are, it is only us and no one else. And unfortunately, they have the money and they are influencing America, the West, to keep quiet, to be silent, to remain silent, even when they killed the people like Khashoggi. This Sheikh Kadhim is, of course, an ordinary, normal cleric who would pray with the people, who would respond to their questions, but he did not present obvious and clear political demands. I think they do not want anyone to establish his foothold in the, among the people. They fear the emergence of people like Sheikh Nimr, who was martyred by the Saudis in 2016.
The angry truckers in Canada have held a third day of protests against the government's mandatory COVID vaccination. Major traffic jams persisted in downtown Ottawa Monday as the so-called Freedom Convoy remained in place near the Parliament building. Organizers are calling it a logistics nightmare to pressure the government into abandoning vaccine mandates. The convoy arrived in the city on Saturday. Participants want an end to vaccine mandates for cross-border travel. So far, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has refused to meet with protesters and listen to their demands. He has blasted acts of sabotage and instances of racist imagery during the rally. Well, Washington is considering strengthening its military foothold on the African continent in an apparent bid to counter the growing influence of its strategic rivals, Russia and China. That has raised concerns, considering America's track record in countries which house its military bases. With more than 20 years of a military presence, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, it's also been involved in coup d'etats and overthrow of several governments.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the US. But that's a cause of concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in West and East Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of US bases. At least seven coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. Last week, a Pentagon report suggested a 70% annual increase in violent events linked to militant groups in the Sahel region. According to the data, last year, attacks across the region jumped from 1,180 to at least 2,005, the most dramatic hike on the continent. Those attacks have killed an estimated 4,800 people last year, accounting for some two-thirds of the total number of terror attack victims in Africa.
Well, I think the U.S. is very much afraid of Africa becoming, the countries of Africa working together and becoming a powerhouse that would be able to rival the United States and rival Western Europe. Because you have to think about it, Africa is a very, very big continent, which much bigger than the United States, with a lot more valuable resources in this modern age. So, I think the United States is afraid.
The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported.
Pentagon's African Command describes itself as designed to promote regional security, stability, and prosperity on the continent, but it does not shy away from admitting that it's working to advance U.S. national interests there. The United States has been involved in the overthrow of 9 governments, and that's while terrorist attacks have increased 70% across Africa, providing another evidence of the U.S.-Africa failure.
The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against Al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, Al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for the civilians killed in its airstrikes. The United States has failed to provide an accurate tally of equipment and resources it has sent to U.S.-Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen to the wrong hands.
So the United States, by picking up this banner that the United Kingdom, the British Empire, left, has basically realized the most effective way to combat any sort of rise of anti-imperialism or any sort of self-determination for these colonized, these exploited countries, is by, instead of just launching a full-out invasion of U.S. forces, that the intelligence agencies should begin covertly funding and fostering organizations that will have inner conflict between the main group, in the case of Mau Mau, by supporting a counter game.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa is the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
SupplyCom of the U.S.-led coalition forces has reportedly come under attack again in southern Iraq. According to reports, the explosion ripped through the convoy on a highway linking Dikar and Muthanna governorates. According to a security source, the convoy was carrying logistical equipment for American forces. No report of casualties or possible damage. There has also been no claim of responsibility. American troops and their military and supply convoys have been repeatedly targeted over the past years. And that amid growing anti-U.S. sentiment in the Arab country. Anger heightened following the U.S. assassination of a top Iranian general and his senior Iraqi commander near Baghdad in January 2020. Israeli forces once again stormed into a refugee camp in the occupied territories and detained dozens of Palestinians. Now, we've talked to our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kendall about these latest events, and she explains that the Israeli regime has expanded its arrest campaigns across the occupied territory.
Israeli forces raided this morning Al-Am'ari refugee camp near Ramallah and arrested at least 21 Palestinians, according to statements coming from Palestinian Prisoners Society and the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs. More Palestinians were detained also in other places, in Beit Lahem, in Qalqilia, and in Nablus. The total number of the people who were detained this morning by Israeli forces is 35. But speaking about 21 Palestinians being detained from a very small area, a refugee camp, Al-Am'ari refugee camp, then here's something, let's say it's weird a little bit. The Israeli military issued a statement yesterday saying that its forces and its military vehicles were exposed to fire from Palestinian fighters in areas in the occupied West Bank and in areas near Ramallah. Maybe this is the reason why the Israeli forces had expanded their arrest campaign across the occupied West Bank, in cities, in refugee camps, in villages. However, Palestinians believe that the Israeli forces don't need excuses to conduct arrests among them.
Now, in other news, Russia saying it will not retreat in the face of U.S. threats, and this while Moscow and the West remain locked in a standoff over Ukraine. Russian embassy in Washington has responded to the recent U.S. sanctions threats. It says Moscow is not sustaining a detention and listening to those threats. The White House has said it's ready to impose sanctions on President Putin's inner circle if Russia attacks Ukraine. The Russian embassy blames Washington for the ongoing tensions. The two countries' top diplomats are set to speak over the phone later on Tuesday. The U.S. and its allies are accusing Russia of planning an imminent invasion of Ukraine. Moscow says it has no plans to start a war, but is demanding binding guarantees that Ukraine won't join NATO. Now, Italy tightens restrictions on people who are still not vaccinated against COVID-19, limiting their access to an array of public places and services. Starting from today, Italians will have to show proof of immunization or recovery from infection to enter public spaces. Now, these include banks, post offices, restaurants, and shopping centers. The restrictions were implemented after vaccination became mandatory for those over 50. Italy has the second highest COVID death toll in Europe after Britain. Meantime, Denmark is the first European country that's set to completely lift most pandemic-related restrictions despite a surge in Omicron variant cases. Authorities claim that COVID-19 is no longer a socially critical disease due to the country's high vaccination rate. However, the capital, Copenhagen, has seen an average of 50,000 daily cases in recent weeks. A UN rights expert on Myanmar, Tom Andrews, says the ruling junta has killed civilians and waged a campaign of terror since last year's coup d'etat. Andrews accuses the military of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. The special UN rapporteur says that he received many reports of mass killings, attacks on hospitals, and the bombing and burning of villages in recent months. According to Andrews, the military is functioning as a criminal enterprise in committing murder, torture, abductions, as well as forced displacement. February 1st marks a year since the military seized control of Myanmar. Streets in some of the main cities were nearly deserted on Tuesday as anti-coup ralliers called for a silent strike. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Epic, glory, honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
In the limelight.
A new analysis published recently revealed that Georgia residents experienced a dramatic increase in mail-in ballot rejections during last year's municipal elections. A developmental report's authors say is attributable to the state's recently enacted Republican-led voter suppression law. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Analysis finds a staggering rise in voter suppression after GOP restrictions in Georgia. Here's more.
Mm-hmm.
A new analysis published recently revealed that Georgia residents experienced a dramatic increase in mail-in ballot rejections during last year's municipal elections, a development the report's authors say is attributable to the state's recently enacted Republican-led voter suppression law. According to reporters Ryan Little and Ari Berman, during municipal elections in November, Georgia voters were 45 times more likely to have their mail ballot applications rejected and ultimately not vote as a result than in 2020. If that same rejection rate were extrapolated to the 2020 race, more than 38,000 votes would not have been cast in a presidential contest decided by just over 11,000 votes. In November 2021, Georgians who successfully obtained mail ballots were also twice as likely to have those ballots rejected once they were submitted compared to the previous year. If that were the case in 2020, about 31,000 fewer votes would have been cast in the presidential election. Election law attorney Mark E. Elias, who along with colleagues won 64 of the 65 lawsuits challenging Joe Biden's 2020 victory, reacted to the Mother Jones report by tweeting, "This is why we are fighting this new law in court. Democracy is on the docket." Elias was referring to SB 202, which was signed into law by Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, last March. As Common Dreams reported at the time, the legislation imposed strict voter identification requirements, significantly limited to the use of absentee ballot drop boxes, eliminated mobile voting vans, and made it a crime to give water to people waiting in line to vote. Little and Berman assert that the disenfranchisement that occurred in the last year's Georgia municipal elections was a direct result of measures to limit mail voting passed by the GOP legislature. More than half of mail ballot applications were rejected because they arrived after the state's newly imposed deadline to request them, they write. In 2020, Georgia voters could request the mail ballot up until the Friday before Election Day. Under the new law signed by Governor Brian Kemp in March 2021, voters must place their request no later than 11 days before the election, which voting rights advocates say is too early and burdensome for many voters. In 2020, more than 21,000 Georgians, including Kemp, who requested his ballot on Election Day, cast their ballots within 11 days of the November 3rd contest, something that is no longer possible due to the new law. Kemp also dropped off his ballot on Election Day, which is now prohibited, as the law he signed cuts off drop box access 4 days before the election. The reporters write, these rejections are having a disproportionate impact on Democratic-leaning constituencies. Black voters, who make up about a third of the electorate in Georgia, accounted for half of all late ballot application rejections, according to the voting rights group Fair Fight Action. Voters 18 to 29 made up just 2.76% of mail voters in 2021, but they constituted 15% of late ballot application rejections. Overall, four times as many Democratic voters requested mail ballots compared to Republicans, they say so, is an increase in rejections will particularly harm their party. The new analysis belies claims by Republicans and right-wing Democratic Senator Joe Manchin that states are not engaged in voter suppression, and the report's authors suggest the data could portend widespread voter disenfranchisement resulting from GOP-led legislation in the 2022 midterm and 2024 general elections. The truly troubling aspect of these numbers is that municipal voters tend to be much more experienced voters, super voters, if you will, who are less likely to make these sorts of errors, like returning their ballots late. Sarah Tyndall-Gazal, a Democratic member of the Georgia State Election Board, told reporters, adding, extrapolating that to a much higher turnout election expected this year suggests that, absent a massive voter education effort, many more eligible voters will be disenfranchised by these onerous restrictions, which seems to me to have been the point. Little and Berman note that Georgia isn't the only state where voters are experiencing difficulty casting ballots due to restrictions enacted by Republican-controlled state legislatures. In one example reported by Common Dreams earlier this month, a number of Texas counties are experiencing an alarming number of mail ballots being rejected in the wake of SB 1, a law signed by Republican Governor Greg Abbott last September. In Travis County, home to Austin, the state capital, around half of all mail-in ballot applications have been rejected. According to Brennan Center for Justice, 19 states passed 34 laws last year, making it harder to vote. Advocates warn of a tidal wave of GOP voter suppression heading into 2022 midterm elections, with restrictive laws coupled with former President Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, posing a serious threat to U.S. democracy, according to the Brennan Center.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are using the sermon number 3, you can say, as a platform to be able to understand this charter of Islamic governance. And of course, Imam Ali alayhi salam in this sermon explains about the purpose of his governance, and one of the aspects that he elaborates and gives importance to is the issue of referring back to history and taking lessons from that. And he talked about how we can learn from our history, and what we can do for the future of our communities. I give the example of the scholar Sayyid Sharafuddin Al-Amili, and also regarding the scholar Mirza Hassan Shirazi, who became the Marja, who became the center of religious authority for the Muslims at his time after Sheikh Ansari passed away. And this was actually a sign of how these scholars were thinking for the future of the community, because they had taken lessons from history and they had learned about what the Muslim community required and what was necessary for the Muslims to get together and for them to progress and to become strong and grow as a society.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Coming back to Sayyid Sharafuddin Al-Amili, he was a scholar who brought back the Shias of Lebanon to honor. You know, they were suffering, they were in humiliation. But he says something very important. And he says, "La yantashiru al-huda illa min haythu intashara al-dhalal." That guidance will not spread except from that very point, or from that very method, or sorry, from that very way that misguidance was spread. Why? Because he saw that the communities had become, the path of knowledge was blocked, the path of understanding their rights was blocked. They were taught that they didn't have rights, they didn't have knowledge, they didn't have to seek knowledge, they didn't have the ability to fight for their rights or to speak the truth. They just had to remain in that state that they were in. That was the way the path of misguidance had manifested for them. The people of misguidance, this is what they wanted them to understand. But the scholars, he says, we need to go through those same paths. Just like they stopped them from knowledge, they spread wrong information through newspapers, they gave them the worst services. We are going to do the opposite. In that same path, we are going to give them an opportunity to learn the real information through our own newsletters and newspapers. We are going to teach them the right method of learning and the right teachings. We are going to transform their understanding about themselves and the community and the society. This was what he did. And therefore he had just a two-room house, and in one room him and his family were staying. In the other room he brought the children of Lebanon and started to train them, started to teach them, to bring them out of this state of ignorance, to bring that path of truth back from where the path of falsehood had entered. He brought life back to the community. And today that small center of learning, that small room, today has become a university. One of the big universities in Lebanon, where people, not only the Lebanese, but foreigners come to learn there. This is something. Why? Because the Sayyid Sharafuddin had learned from history. He had learned that how evil and misguidance comes, it's, you need to look at where the evil is spreading from, and from that very area of spreading of the evil, you spread the truth. This was what he did.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, this was the example of Sayyid Sharafuddin, who had actually learned from the path of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha, of course, we discussed the various phrases of this sermon. The final one was this: Ala wa inna maliyatakum qad aabat ka hayatiha yawma ba'atha Allahu nabiyyakum sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. That your problem has returned, the issue of polytheism has returned to you, so you need to fight that polytheism. Imam Ali alayhi salam clearly says that this polytheism, this allowing people to rule with their own whims and desires and being under their authority without them having a divine authority from God, this is wrong, this is polytheism. People who felt that they can be in power just because they were, for example, they are rich, or they were respected, or they had certain money, or they had a certain a position in the society, they forcefully want to take over the authority. This won't happen with Imam Ali's governance. This shirk has to be pushed away. That's why Imam Ali alayhi salam then says, وَالَّذِي بَعَثَهُ بِالْحَقِّ, that I swear by the one who sent the Prophet with truth, لَتُبَلْبَلُنَّ بَلْبَلَةً وَلَتُغَرْبَلُنَّ غَرْبَلَةً, that you will be shaken, a severe shaking. You will be, moved around severely. وَلَتُسَاطُنَّ سَوْتَ الْقِدَرِ, you will be, pushed around, you will be changed, you will be shaken very severely. That's what will happen to you, just like when you shake sand and dust, you shake it severely, that's how you'll be shaken. حَتَّى يَعُودَ أَسْفَلَكُمْ عَلَاكُمْ وَعَلَاكُمْ أَسْفَلَكُمْ. Inshallah, we will discuss this phrase, which is very important, inshallah, in the coming sessions. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه, هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه, هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا, باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله, من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه, هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى, هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Despite the Saudi-led US-backed coalition's increased attacks against Yemen, Yemen's retaliatory attacks were met with denunciation by coalition allies, including the Biden administration and the UN Security Council. Even the Zionist regime proclaimed its support for the UAE. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ahmed Abdul Karim, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Falling Unjustifiable UAE Bombing of Saadet Prison, US and UN Condemn Yemeni Retaliation. Stay tuned for more. In a scene rife with chaos and crying, volunteers and a rescue squad pulled the bodies of 91 prisoners from the rubble of the Saadet city, Rimman prison in southern Yemen recently. United Arab Emirates warplanes supported by the United States targeted the overcrowded prison, which houses up to 3,000 inmates from across Yemen and Africa. The attack was one of the deadliest since the war began in 2015. At least 91 people were killed and more than 236 seriously injured in the attacks, which left bereaved families in shock across Yemen and Africa. Witnesses described the scene of the attack in its first minutes as chaotic and tragic. Fighter jets were heard over the skies of Saadet, while people were sleeping before their violent explosions were heard from the prison. Red fires mixed with dust and smoke illuminated flying rubble. The bodies of prisoners fueled the inferno as the screams and cries of those that survived the initial onslaught echoed from bombed-out buildings. The death toll is expected to rise as many victims of the strike remain in critical condition and hospitals struggle to cope with a lack of medical supplies as a result of a Saudi coalition imposed siege that began in 2015. The hospital is facing a very difficult situation with casualties lying on the hospital floor as rescuers continue to claw through the rubble searching for survivals, Doctors Without Borders said in a statement. Yemen's Ministry of Health has launched an urgent appeal abroad to send medical aid and doctors to Yemen, as hospitals are already crowded with a number of victims from previous airstrikes, as well as an urgent appeal for Yemeni citizens to donate blood. Despite the Saudi-led coalition denying any knowledge of the attack, international organizations including the United Nations, International Red Cross, and Doctors Without Borders confirmed that the coalition was responsible. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' spokesman Stephen Dujarric said that the UN chief had condemned the airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition against a detention center in Sa'da city. Doctors Without Borders called the airstrike unjustifiable and said that Saudi Arabia and its allies have no way to deny that this is an airstrike. Everyone in Sa'da city heard it. This is the latest in a long line of unjustifiable airstrikes carried out by the Saudi-led coalition on places like schools, hospitals, markets, wedding parties and prisons. Ahmad Mahad, the head of the Doctors Without Borders mission in Yemen, said in the wake of the attack. The attack, which came after the UN Human Rights Council voted to end the mandate of the group of eminent experts on Yemen, the only international and independent body tasked with investigating the full extent of violations in the war, was not the only onslaught that took place recently. More than 14 people, mostly women and children, were killed when US-backed fighter jets struck the home of a former high-ranking military official in Sana'a. Recently, at least 6 civilians, including a number of children, were killed and 18 injured after Saudi jets bombed a communications center in Hodeidah. Local authorities recovered the bodies of the victims, who were mostly children playing near the building. The attack, which leveled a 3-story building to the ground, targeted Yemen's internet infrastructure in a likely bid to quell reporting on the Saudi coalition's attack on the prison. The attacks sparked anger across Yemen and around the world. Recently, massive crowds took to the streets across Yemen not only to condemn the prison attack and the recent coalition bombardment of Sa'da, Sana'a, and Al-Hudaydah, but also to blame the United States for supporting the Riyadh and Abu Dhabi regimes. Protesters also appealed to the Yemen army led by Ansarullah to seek revenge for their recent attacks. In retaliation for the attacks, the Yemen army, led by Ansarullah, launched military operations against both Saudi Arabia and UAE. Dubbed Operation Yemen Hurricane, the operation saw a flurry of ballistic missiles and drone attacks against the Saudi-led coalition. Yemeni forces launched massive strikes using large Zulfiqar ballistic missiles and Samad 3 drones against sensitive targets in UAE and Saudi Arabia, including Al Dhafra Air Base south of Abu Dhabi, where American forces are stationed. 2,000 American troops Al Dhafra took shelter in bunkers during the attack, which was intended as a warning to the United States that its continued support for Saudi Arabia is no longer acceptable and could be met by direct attacks, a high-ranking Ansarullah military official told Mint Press. Other sites in Abu Dhabi and Dubai were targeted, while squadrons of Samad 1st and Qasif 2K combat drones struck a number of Saudi-led coalition military camps in Sharura, a town in Saudi Arabia's southern region of Najran. The attack is the second on the UAE. The first took place on January 17th, targeting sensitive sites including oil tanks in Musafa ICAD 3 area, in addition to a construction site at the Abu Dhabi International Airport. Despite the coalition's increased attacks against Yemen, Yemen's retaliatory attacks were met with denunciation by coalition allies, including the Biden administration and the UN Security Council. Even the Zionist regime proclaimed its support for the UAE. None of the aforementioned have yet to condemn Saudi Arabia for the attack on the prison or for other human rights violations committed in Yemen. The reality now is that condemnations mean nothing to the many Yemenis who believe that military escalation is the only effective way to deter Saudi Arabia and the UAE. According to statements from Sana'a, the retaliatory attacks will not stop, whatever the denunciations, and will expand until the UAE withdraws from the country. The UAE will no longer be safe. We are calling on foreign companies and investors to leave for the sake of their safety. The Yemen army has repeated in all its statements on the topic.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Aqa on IRIB English Radio. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful tradition which has been narrated from our sixth Imam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. This Hadith is about self-scrutiny and alludes to the benefits of self-scrutiny and its place in Islam, and also the problems that arise when somebody foregoes this good trait. In this tradition, Imam says, "The man for whom each day passes exactly the same as another, where there is no change in his character or his deeds, is indeed a loser." The Imam in this tradition, he separates three people from one another. In other words, he kind of divides human beings into four groups. Two basic groups, you know, good people and bad people, and then these bad people, these evil people, he divides them into three categories. The first is the man for whom each day passes exactly is the same as the other, in the sense that the previous day and the next day are the same for him. He doesn't really change. He doesn't change either for the worse or for the better. The Imam characterizes this person as a loser. Right. Okay. The second category is this, and the man for whom the next day is always worse than the previous day is indeed cursed. Right. So if he is a person whose subsequent day is worse than the previous one, this person is a person who is cursed. And finally, the third category is the category of the person who the Imam describes in the following way. And the man who never sees to improve himself day after day is indeed at a loss. Right. You might be asking, where does this allude to self-scrutiny? Well, if a person wants to remove these traits from himself, it's necessary for him to scrutinize himself, to look at his actions every day, to see, you know, in which category he falls, right? So as to avoid falling into any of these categories, it's necessary for us to take account of ourselves, to assess ourselves, to look at ourselves, how our day passed, right? So we don't fall into one of these categories of bad people and evil people. And whoever passes his days in such loss, the Imam says, death is surely better for him. Right? At least by dying, you know, his days have finished, and he can't say that this day is worse than the previous one, or the same as the previous one, or he hasn't improved. But death, surely death is better for such a person than living. And this is really such a bad trait. So in order for us to avoid such falling into such a trap and or falling into one of these categories, it's necessary for us to improve ourselves every day, right? So the necessary concomitant of this tradition is that a good person is a person who is constantly improving every day, right? Well, so how can we do this? We can do this when we assess how we are every day. Look at our faults, look at our good deeds, try to remove the faults, and try to improve and intensify, you know, our good traits, so that we, you know, don't fall into one of these categories. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at self-scrutiny in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Aqa for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.